Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. I'm your host, Cale Clark. We're going through a series called War and Peace. What is the church's teaching about these issues in light of the war in Ukraine? Here's a question that comes up a lot. What about the use of nuclear weapons? Vladimir Putin frightened the entire world when he said the other day that nuclear options are on the table. As frightening as that is, that does make us reflect on the events that ended World War II, when the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, hastening the end of World War II. But was that moral? Was that legitimate? We're going to talk about that a little bit later on the show because it's part of the church's doctrine on war in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Now, I want you to open up your catechism with me if you have one. It's also available online. You can find it. The Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2307. If you don't have one, no problem. I'll read it out to you. This is paragraph 2307. This is in a section called Avoiding War. And once again, this is all kind of a subsection of the discussion on the fifth commandment. You shall not kill or you shall not murder. So paragraph 2307 says this: the fifth commandment forbids the intentional destruction of human life. Because of the evils and injustices that accompany all war, the church insistently urges everyone to prayer and to action so that the divine goodness may free us from the ancient bondage of war. And that's a good thing to mention, that every war has a certain measure of evils and injustices. There is a proper way to go about waging war, but that's often not respected. A lot of people think war throws morality out the window, anything goes. That's not true, as we're going to see in just a minute. Let's look at the next paragraph in the Catechism, paragraph 2308. It says, all citizens and all governments are obliged to work for the avoidance of war. However, as long as the danger of war persists and there is no international authority with the necessary competence and power, governments cannot be denied the right of lawful self-defense once all peace efforts have failed. So we try, first of all, to maintain peace, but if that doesn't work, then there is such a thing as lawful self-defense. Now, what makes for a lawful self-defense in the case of war between nations? That's what it spells out in the very next paragraph of the Catechism. Let's look at paragraph 2309. And by the way, as the Catechism says here, these are the traditional elements of what's called the just war doctrine or the just war teaching of the church. It says the strict conditions for legitimate defense by military force require rigorous consideration. The gravity of such a decision makes it subject to rigorous conditions of moral legitimacy. At one and the same time, here are the conditions here. The damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, it must be grave, and it must be certain. So it has to be very, very weighty. The second condition, all other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. In other words, diplomacy has failed in stopping this unjust aggressor. The third condition, there must be serious prospects of success. And sometimes you have to defend yourself even if there doesn't seem to be much human hope for success. The brave people of Ukraine are a great example of that. And then the last condition here, the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. Now, this is a tricky one, and a great example of this is the legitimate or illegitimate use of atomic weapons. We'll talk about that in just a second. The use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver, or even worse, than the evil that you're trying to eliminate. Catechism goes on, the power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition. So those are the four conditions of waging just war. The damage must be, whoever's trying to attack you, it's got to be lasting damage, grave damage, and certain unavoidable damage. Diplomacy has failed. All other means of trying to put an end to it have been ineffective. There's got to be serious prospects of success. And any use of arms or weaponry cannot produce greater evils than the evil you're trying to get rid of here. So that's the Church's just war doctrine right there, laid out in paragraph 2309 of the Catechism. It goes on to say in the very next paragraph, public authorities in this case have the right and the duty to impose on citizens the obligations necessary for national defense. Now, obviously, those are people, there are certainly people in every country who have willingly volunteered to serve in the armed forces. And here's what it says about that in the Catechism. It says, those who are sworn to serve their country in the armed forces are servants of the security and freedom of nations. If they carry out their duty honorably, they truly contribute to the common good of the nation in the maintenance of peace. All right, and that's a quote by Vatican II, a document Gaudium et Spes. So there's kind of a link to a couple other paragraphs here in the Catechism. It says, it is the duty of citizens, this is paragraph 2239, it's the duty of citizens to contribute along with the civil authorities to the good of society in a spirit of truth, justice, solidarity, and freedom. The love and service of one's country follow from the duty of gratitude and belong to the order of charity. Submission to legitimate authorities and service of the common good require citizens to fulfill their roles in the life of the political community. So certainly that would involve things like voting. And there are some people who, out of a draw of patriotism, wanting to serve your country, loving your country, grateful to what it's given you, they want to belong to the armed forces in order to defend her, whatever nation that might be. And it says also in paragraph 1909 of the Catechism, the common good requires peace. You have to have peace for common good in society. And how is peace defined here? The stability and security of a just order. It presupposes that authority should ensure, by morally acceptable means, the security of society and its members. It is the basis of the right to legitimate personal and collective defense. Okay, so a just order. Now, a lot of orders out there in the world are not exactly just. There's order, but it's not just. Maybe it's a brutal dictatorship. It has some form of order. So that's not the ideal. So we should try to move closer and closer to that ideal. Even in democratic countries, it's not always perfect, but we strive for it. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. Let's look now at paragraph 2311 of the Catechism as we continue this discussion of war and peace. This is fascinating. This has to do with the topic of conscience, especially when it comes to warfare. It says in paragraph 2311, public authorities should make equitable provision for those who, for reasons of conscience, refuse to bear arms. These are nonetheless obliged to serve the human community in some other way. And again, this comes from Vatican II's Gaudium et Spes, Joy and Hope. So this is really interesting. When you think about people who are conscientious objectors to war, the image that comes to my mind immediately is that of Cassius Clay / Muhammad Ali, who refused to serve in the Vietnam War and would rather have gone to prison for it, and he did, because he disagreed with it. He thought it was an unjust war for reasons of conscience. In paragraph 1782 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it says, man has the right to act in conscience and in freedom so as personally to make moral decisions. He must not be forced to act contrary to his conscience, nor must he be prevented from acting according to his conscience, especially in religious matters. That is a very, very important paragraph in the Catechism, 1782. And there's another one in paragraph 1790. It says, a human being must always obey the certain judgment of his conscience. If he were deliberately to act against it, he would condemn himself. Yet it can happen that moral conscience remains in ignorance and makes erroneous judgments about acts to be performed or already committed. Okay, another important paragraph there. So 1782 and 1790. So we have the obligation to act according to our conscience. And this is something when I was coming back into the Catholic Church, I remember hearing this and thinking, this doesn't seem to make sense to me. But the church essentially teaches that you must obey your conscience, even when it's wrong. That seems unbelievable, but conscience is sacrosanct. Now, your conscience can be an error, though. The church even admits consciences can err. This is why we need to educate people in the faith. This is why we need to evangelize, because the word conscience means, well, if you break it down, it's con science, with knowledge in the Latin. So some people are not acting with knowledge. They have a malformed conscience, a conscience that is in ignorance, and it needs to be informed about the moral law, about God's revealed law. And so that's what we need to do. But we have to respect it when people say, I can't do this according to my conscience. Especially when it comes to fulfilling religious duties, making moral decisions. You can't force somebody to act against their conscience, the Catechism says. And you can't prevent somebody from acting according to their conscience, especially when it comes to the fulfillment of religious duties. So very, very important point there. Let's look in the next paragraph, 2312 of the Catechism. It says, the church and human reason both assert the permanent validity of the moral law during armed conflict. Okay, so this is important. This is human reason, and this is also the teaching of the church. It's reasonable, and it's also in accord with Revelation. The mere fact, it says, that war has regrettably broken out does not mean that everything becomes licit between warring parties. And that's, again, a quote from Gaudium et Spes. In paragraph 2313, the very next one, it says, non-combatants, wounded soldiers, and prisoners must be respected and treated humanely. And there's a link to another paragraph, which is 2242, that says that the citizen is obliged in conscience not to follow the directives of civil authorities when they are contrary to the demands of the moral order, to the fundamental rights of persons, or the teachings of the gospel. So it's really, really important to note that in an armed conflict, this does not mean that anything goes. This does not mean that morality is thrown out the window and you can dehumanize your opponents and people that belong to the other nation that you're in conflict with, many of whom are quite innocent. And so attacking civilians is always considered a grave abuse. It's always considered usually a war crime, attacking non-combatants. And so the humane treatment of prisoners, that's very, very important. There was a great example of the gospel in action when just recently a Russian soldier surrendered to Ukrainian forces, and many of the Ukrainians made sure he had something to eat and took care of him, allowed him to call his mother. And so this was exactly the gospel in action, kindness to even your enemies. And that poor young man probably didn't know what he was getting into in the first place. Who knows? But that's a good example. And so it goes on to say in the Catechism here, paragraph 2242, refusing obedience to civil authorities when their demands are contrary to those of an upright conscience finds its justification in the distinction between serving God and serving the political community. Sometimes people want to make those two things the same. They want to say that they're building some sort of a theocracy. To serve this government is to serve God himself. Well, Jesus says, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. And of course, he said that in Matthew 22:21, a couple other places as well in the other Gospels. But one of the things that was noted by St. Peter in the Acts of the Apostles, they were commanded not to preach in the name of Christ, and they were beaten. They suffered for the sake of the name. Peter says, we must obey God rather than men. Yes, you are the authority that's here, and you're telling us not to do this, but you are breaking God's law. The directions of your authority is contrary to the demands of God. God has commanded us to preach this message. That's Acts chapter 5, verse 29. One quote here also from Vatican II, from Gaudium et Spes. It says, when citizens are under the oppression of a public authority which oversteps its competence, they should still not refuse to give or to do what is objectively demanded of them by the common good. But it is legitimate for them to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens against the abuse of this authority within the limits of the natural law and the law of the gospel. So that's really important. Let's continue on here. It says that in paragraph 2313 of the Catechism, actions deliberately contrary to the law of nations and to its universal principles are crimes, as are the orders that command such actions. Now listen to this. Blind obedience does not suffice to excuse those who carry them out. So you can't say, as some of the Nazis tried to claim on trial at Nuremberg, I was only following orders. That's not a legitimate defense. It goes on to say in the Catechism, thus the extermination of a people, of a nation, or an ethnic minority must be condemned as a mortal sin. One is morally bound to resist orders that command genocide. Next paragraph, 2314, every act of war directed to the indiscriminate destruction of whole cities or vast areas with their inhabitants is a crime against God and man, which merits firm and unequivocal condemnation. That's, again, a quote from Gaudium et Spes, Vatican II. And it says, a danger of modern warfare is that it provides the opportunity to those who possess modern scientific weapons, especially atomic, biological, or chemical weapons, to commit such crimes. So again, we're going to get into this in just a bit. This paragraph is directly applicable to the case of the use of nuclear weapons. But first, we just got to clean up a couple things here. Let's look at the next paragraph, 2315 in the Catechism. It says, the accumulation of arms strikes many as a paradoxically suitable way of deterring potential adversaries from war. So this idea that, you know, I've got more firepower than you, this should deter you from warfare. This should actually keep the peace. And there's certainly some logic in that. Catechism goes on to say, they see it as the most effective means of ensuring peace among nations. This method of deterrence, though, gives rise to strong moral reservations. The arms race does not ensure peace. Far from eliminating the causes of war, it risks aggravating them. Spending enormous sums to produce ever new types of weapons impedes efforts to aid needy populations. It thwarts the development of peoples. Overarmament multiplies reasons for conflict and increases the danger of escalation. So there's no question that there perhaps is a legitimate armament of nations, but Catechism talks about over-armament. And the danger of escalation is very real. I read recently about a time when President Donald Trump, when he was in office, visited Russian President Putin, and Vladimir Putin kept telling him, apparently, according to this conversation, the report of it that I heard, hey, we've got hypersonic missiles. You know, you don't have them yet. And he was kind of like saying, you know, watch out. It was very chilling. But when I think about escalation, I always think about the movie Batman Begins, this big superhero fan. There's a final scene in the movie Batman Begins where Commissioner Jim Gordon, the police commissioner of Gotham City, he finally unveils the Bat Signal, the famous Bat Signal at the end of the movie. He's meeting with Batman on the top of the police building. And he's talking to the Dark Knight, and he brings up this concept of escalation. Commissioner Gordon says, you know, don't forget about escalation. Batman says, what are you talking about? And Gordon says, we start carrying semi-automatics, they buy automatics. He's talking about the criminals. We start wearing Kevlar, you know, bulletproof vests. They buy armor-piercing rounds. You start wearing a mask and jumping off of buildings, and then he shows them the calling card of the Joker. It's almost like he's almost implying that maybe Batman, by going to such extremes in fighting crime, has almost perhaps been the cause of the Joker. Not really, but there is this danger of escalation, right? Did he inspire him in some way? Not intentionally, but there is that problem. All right, let's go now to the next paragraph, 2316 in the Catechism. It says, the production and the sale of arms affect the common good of nations and of the international community. Hence, public authorities have the right and the duty to regulate them. The short-term pursuit of private or collective interests cannot legitimate undertakings that promote violence and conflict among nations and compromise the international juridical order. Okay, next paragraph. Injustice, this is 2317. Injustice, excessive economic or social inequalities, envy, distrust, and pride raging among men and nations constantly threaten peace and cause wars. Everything done to overcome these disorders contributes to building up peace and avoiding war. And there's another quote here, again from Gaudium et Spes. This section of the Catechism draws heavily on this Vatican II document. It says, insofar as men are sinners, the threat of war hangs over them and will so continue until Christ comes again. As we talked about in our last episode, there is no lasting peace in the world without the Prince of Peace. But insofar as they can vanquish sin by coming together in charity, violence itself will be vanquished, and these words will be fulfilled. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And that's a quote from the book of Isaiah, chapter 2, verse 4, this famous beating the swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. So that kind of brings us to the end of this section in the Catechism on war, which is really a subset of the fifth commandment, you shall not murder. Let's just briefly sum up here. There is a couple of concluding paragraphs, very, very brief sentences. You see this at the end of sections in the Catechism. There's a section called In Brief. Paragraph 2318, that's really just a sentence. In God's hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. And that's actually a quote from the book of Job. And it's true. Peter, going back to the Acts of the Apostles, what did he say? What did he say after Pentecost had come, the Holy Spirit had been poured out? And Peter's preaching to the multitudes, and he says, you killed the author of life. God is the author of life. And who killed him? Who killed Jesus Christ? We all did through our sins. And this is why in the movie, The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson, who directed the film, he had himself, his own hands, his face never appeared on screen, but it was his hands that were pounding in the iron spikes as Jim Caviezel, who was playing Jesus, was crucified, quote-unquote, in the movie, to emphasize that all of us are guilty of putting Christ on the cross, but he is the author of life. And he came back from the dead through his powerful resurrection on Easter Sunday. In the book of Revelation, Jesus says, I hold the keys of death and of Hades. So that really does amplify the words of Job. In God's hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. We've got to respect people's lives because of God. So there's so many things that it says here in this section on the Catechism. It does say this, skipping ahead a little bit, paragraph 2327, because of the evils and injustices that all war brings with it, we must do everything reasonably possible to avoid it. The church prays, from famine, pestilence, and war, O Lord, deliver us. It goes on in the next paragraph, 2328, the church and human reason assert the permanent validity of the moral law during armed conflicts. Practices deliberately contrary to the law of nations and to its universal principles are crimes. So again, it's not like anything goes in warfare. The moral law is still in play. Paragraph 2329, the arms race is one of the greatest curses on the human race, and the harm it inflicts on the poor is more than what can be endured. And then finally, the very last paragraph in this section, it ends off with the words of Jesus Christ, which is very appropriate. It says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God," or children of God. And that's in Matthew chapter 5, verse 9. It's interesting, when Jesus said this, blessed are the peacemakers, obviously one of the Beatitudes, the seventh Beatitude, it's really distinctive. It's the only time that word is in the New Testament, peacemakers. So it's kind of a new thing, the peace that only is possible through the Messiah, the Prince of Peace, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. He's going to get peace. He's going to be able to bring about peace ultimately in the world. Now, Jesus actually says that the peacemakers will be called children of God. All throughout the Old Testament, righteous persons are called sons of God, children of God. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1, you are the children of the Lord your God. In Hosea chapter 1, verse 10, children of the living God. The rabbis talked about it as well. They talked about making peace between people, loving peace, pursuing peace. And so if you want to be like God, if you want to have that family resemblance to God as children of God, then we've got to strive for what he strives for, which is in fact the peace of Christ. That is what we're looking for. And so, believe it or not, it's even in outside of the Bible, it's even in Greco-Roman literature, this idea. Sextus once wrote this, "A chaste or a pure and sinless person has power in God's sight as a child of God." And so we need to use our power in God's sight as children of God to pray for peace in the world and do what we can to bring about it. And in the next episode, we'll conclude the series by looking at the thorny question of nuclear armaments. Was it right? Was it morally justified for the United States to use the atomic bomb? Can that ever morally be used again? We're going to look at this question in the next episode of The Faith Explained. Until then, I'm your host, Cale Clark. If you missed an episode, you can check the podcast. Please give us a rating and a review if you listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It does help people to find us. If you have a question, show topics that you'd like to share with us, something you'd like us to cover, a question that you'd like to have answered, you can email us, faith@relevantradio.com, and you can also follow us on Twitter, @FaithExplained, and my personal handle, @CaleClark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Until next time, I am Cale Clark for The Faith Explained. We'll see you then. God bless you.